Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. And as we, you know, have the typical obligatories, I usually try to just not go into all those details when we're covering content. But let me just remind you, we've got a YouTube channel, Reclaiming the Republic. And if you go to Reclaiming the Republic, you'll get our content that we're putting up there. As a matter of fact, we did put a portion of the Michelle Bachmann interview, and so that's available up there. And in addition to that, we're hoping to actually get these ratification debates up there. We're hoping to get the Constitution, and who knows? We want to get as much up there before Facebook kicks us off. Now, I will tell you, in your own interest, if you happen to live in a state and you're getting organized and everything else, I would just recommend that you download this and all other relevant reference material that is absolutely necessary to help everybody understand the academic argument of what we need to do, how we got into this position academically, you know, like the Reynolds v. Sims stuff that we're covering in the counties matter the most and so forth. But I don't want to dive into a deep ditch or deep rat hole. We've got Paul. We're covering the South Carolina debates. And Paul, so welcome back. And
Thanks, we
kind of ended in a situation where you asked me a question, I just didn't have the time. We just literally ran out of time. And so I'm not sure, it's been so long ago. Do you remember the question?
Oh my, hang on. We were reading from
it was about slavery.
Pinckney. And let me see. All men are born free and not. So I was, I think I had made a commentary against the insertion of the Bill of Rights. Okay.
Okay.
And what? Oh, that they so. Oh, I remember what the commentary is that I wanted to make. You were talking about how, you know, slavery had been something that was, you know, on the earth for like 5,000 years.
Yes.
Right. And so,
right.
And so what happened is here we come to this focal point in which we've got the formation of the Constitution. We've got an institution that's been not just in America, it's been so part of the global culture for so long. It winds up here. We've got people who grew up with it, you know. It's like a habit, you know. You don't snap your fingers and it's gone. You
right.
Know, someone
right.
who's an alcoholic, they don't just snap their fingers and they're sober.
Right.
And so what happens is, but what the good thing is here is that they, unlike the Articles of Confederation, they baked into the Constitution the beginning of the end.
So they thought. So they thought. Absolutely. And as a matter of fact, I'll even correct that. As inspired by the divine hand of providence.
Okay.
But now, Satan wasn't going to have any of it.
Right. So they baked it in. Now, but listening to and reading this argument, these folks believed, hey, let's take what we can get because there's a chance we could continue to live with slavery. So, like you say, I believe, in fact, it's my personal conviction that it was God's intention to do away with slavery, and especially in the United States. In fact, that here would be a place where it would end. And so, you know, within 70 years, well, we had a real fight on our hands, which kind of brought it to a screeching halt. I also believe that had Remember, you and I've had this discussion before, and it has to do with the petitions.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Back then, Congress understood the First Amendment petition process because they heard petitions.
Yep.
Well, around the time that the abolitionists started petitioning the petition Congress, uh-huh. I don't know if they started, but I guess around the 1830s or something, guess what? Congress stopped listening to petitions.
Well, no. They stopped in the 1830s because they still listened to petitions. But they stopped listening to any petition regarding slavery. They put a gag order on it.
That's unfortunate. Because we wound up paying for it later.
Yeah, right. So let's look historically. So, again, slavery was in every culture. Every culture. In one form or another. Now, interestingly enough, the Asian culture, the Chinese specifically, for thousands and thousands of years, have lived under a compulsive state. In other words, instead of actually having slavery handed out to separate individuals as, you know, a form of government where, you know, they're, you know, and to be clear, slavery was an equal opportunity. It was usually done within your own region, you know, and it wasn't until we became, you know, international regarding trade and so forth where we started trading slaves. In other words, slaves were always usually, I'll say, inbred. And in some cases, we even see biblically that there were people that became slaves because they couldn't pay their debt. And they, you know, as a matter of honor, you know, they became a slave to pay their debt. And all debt was to be expunged after 7 years, right? Or I think it was 6 years and
no, 7 years.
Okay. So regardless, at that point in time, it was up to the individual whether they wanted to stay in service or go and, you know, try again. And so every culture had these unique nuances, but it was in every culture. And how it was in Chinese was because they lived collectively, they kind of surrendered to classes of people. They, instead of having what we would call monarchs, like the formal monarchs, they had dynasties and they were families and so forth. And so they actually had a caste system. And it wasn't necessarily a racial caste system other than a certain class of and bloodline, you know, had this prominence. And so because of the nature of, you know, the client, you know, I'll just say the terrain, there were some areas that was very good, but mostly, you know, you had to do terracing. It was tough living and it required not just one person to do it, but they actually kind of all got along and they kind of willingly created this system of compulsion where, you know, government basically mandated. And if you were a laborer, that you were told what to do. And so, in other words, it was like communism in practice for thousands of years. So,
yeah.
And it's not necessarily, you know, when I paint that picture, it is not necessarily, you know, completely accurate that way. But bottom line, that was their society. As a matter of fact, they don't believe that, you know, every individual is equal and every individual should have equal opportunity and so forth. They actually believe that there are certain people that are, you know, must be in service and certain people are entitled to have service. In other words, right. There's those who give the service and there's those that receive that service. And those are, you know, responsibilities and entitlements kind of thing or destiny. Anyway, so every cult
in their history and they live it even now.
Yes, absolutely. As a matter of fact, when Ambassador Lee from Washington State went there and he was leaving the airport and the national news caught pictures of him because I think it was either Bush or Obama that sent him over there. He was a liberal Democrat and he was carrying his own bags. And the national media made fun of him because he didn't have any servants carrying bags for him.
You mean the Chinese national media?
Yes, the Chinese national media. In other words, they mocked him to say, look at these powerful, you know, Americans. They carry their own bags. And so back to the all these different cultures, every culture had some form of compulsion. But interestingly enough, and when we look at the seven marvels of the world that were made by mankind, whether it be the Taj Mahal, the Great Wall of China, every single edifice that has been risen, the pyramids, what have you, all of those edifices have been raised by slavery. You know, it's not like people said, you know what, I think I want to spend the rest of my life and my children's life in laboring to build this great wall.
Right.
You know, it was, they came along and said, you, and they just grabbed you and you became a slave. Now, interestingly enough, there was a uniqueness in Egypt because Egypt had foreigners living among them called the Israelites. And they just said, you know what? These guys are the root of all of our problems. We should just enslave them. And so when usually in every society, when they're done with their project, like the Taj Mahal, then the people are freed again. In other words, once the people have served their purpose, this great grand purpose for this, you know, big collective effort, then they kind of let them go. But they're still, you know, I won't say there won't be an end to slavery, but the mass enslavement of people would be kind of broken up. Not ending, but broken up. Now, there's only two points in time where, you know, I believe the divine hand of providence intervened. And this is one of the reasons why this is never taught as far as American history and slavery, as well as the release and the freedom of Israel, because they don't want people to know that slavery was ended in Egypt by the divine hand of providence, by the hand of God. And if people really start looking in America, how everything was coming to be in this quasi, you know, Christian denominational union of states from the Declaration of Independence into the forming of the Constitution, it became realized that slavery must end. Mm-hmm. And so we see these two separate directions going forward, where we kind of, it's kind of in the plan. And many people see, this only proves the confusion on the individuals, where people walked away and go, this is a good deal, and there's a good chance that we're going to be able to keep this. Well, the actualization of this plan came after the end of the Treaty of Ghent, after the end of the harassments, and when America could actually start enjoying, you know, some freedoms and liberty on the seas and so forth, where Britain finally started honoring its treaty. Not that Britain was happy. As a matter of fact, Britain was doing anything and everything they could to get back to us and to basically put them under their thumb again, because, you know, they had all these other parts of the Commonwealth. They still had Canada. They had, you know, Australia and all these other places. So they weren't happy letting this huge chunk break away from the British Empire. Anyway, as we move forward, the Monroe Doctrine, not the Monroe Doctrine, under Monroe, the Missouri Compromise was a true manifestation that slavery was going to come to an end. In other words, the design actually was bearing fruit. It wasn't until politicians had to step in. It was almost like, you know, witches and witchcraft had to come in to, you know, try to bandage up, you know, this monster that we were kind of maintaining in America. And it was those efforts that extended it and forced us to shed blood one more time.
You're saying, had it not been for the Missouri Compromise,
yes,
slavery probably would have died on the vine.
Absolutely would have, because Missouri would have came into the Union not a slave state, and Texas would have came into the Union as not a slave state.
Here's something that most people don't know. You and I had this conversation, and it shocked me. Didn't you tell me that even Mexico considered becoming a state, but they rejected it because of the Missouri Compromise?
Yeah, absolutely, because Mexico would have actually had to become a slave state, and they didn't want to have anything to do with that. I mean, they didn't like oppressive, you know, I'll just say oppressive types of government. They lived under one when Spain was basically ruling them.
I think most Americans, considering what we're dealing with today on the border, most Americans would find it a shocking piece of information that Mexico at one point wanted to be a state. I'd like to be able to find the documentation for that.
Yeah, so it's not that hard. It's basically they didn't apply to become a state. America actually sent it to them, but they were already aware of this fact of the Monroe Doctrine. See, Mexico started pursuing its freedom after the Missouri Compromise.
Wow.
If you look at their revolutions, I believe it was right after 1820. There were a lot of things that were set in motion in this nation around that time frame. A lot of things. And so I don't want to go into, you know, the full history of what all those things were, you know, like the evangelical movement and the Second Great Awakening in America. I mean, there there was a lot, you know, the beginning of the Great Expanse by iron, you know, by these iron horses or the railroad trade, and how the government, right, and how the federal government got involved in this. And they started utilizing this, and they ended up basically taking full control to where our railroad system today is, you know, fully subsidized, practically fully subsidized by the government. And so, you know, who do you blame when the infrastructure of the railroad system is absolutely decaying, or better yet, that we're having all of these problems? You know, why these trains are derailing and so forth. And it's just a coincidence. All of a sudden, in one year, we have a whole bunch of trains. No, these are operations.
Yes.
Anyway, so... So where we were is we've actually wrapped up the last day of the ratification debates in January. So what ended up happening, and I'm not sure if it was where they were meeting, but there was a fire in the Capitol and the state houses, and so some of the records were actually destroyed. And they actually make a note of it right here in the ratification debates. And they basically suspend the ratification debates at that point in time for a later period with coming back in May. Now, I'm going to believe that not all the same people came back because, you know, if you're based on a seasonal drive or what have you, you may be free in January, but that doesn't mean you'll be free to be able to do those things. So some people may have had to say, well, I can't come back. So they may have had other elections to bring people back. I don't know, because we don't have a roll call of who attended the first session and who attended the last, but I'm going to have to guess that they couldn't get everybody to come back. That's usually a problem, even in today. So in May 20th, as they convene again, and this is really the very last two items. And so actually, you know, if you're not ready for it, we're actually going to be going into, let me find out here. Because I got to go into the state order because I need to look at this. So we covered Massachusetts, then Carolina. So the next ratification debates would be Virginia. And then the next one would be New York. But actually, we're going to cover North Carolina before New York. New York will be the last one because I figured we might as well, you know, go out with, you know, I prefer going out with a positive, but, you know, New York is one of those that is just lackluster. It's just, it doesn't bring a lot to the table, the New York ratification debate. Now, I may be wrong, but I really just believe that there was just an equality of sentiment where there wasn't needing to be as much conviction. It just needed to, you know, to actually create a big enough, I'll say, motivation for New York to join the union. Because if you really look at it, they, you know, after Virginia joined the union, it was New York, it was done. New York
right.
joined the Union because the debates really kind of just fizzled out, and they said, okay, well, you know, are we really not going to join the Union? That really becomes the question now. Are we really not going to join the Union? And as a matter of fact, I'll even say this. During the Virginia ratification debates, when I think it was Vermont that ratified, no, it was New Hampshire. Vermont hadn't come in yet. So New Hampshire had just ratified, and Virginia, in other words, the federal government had its nine states.
Right.
And during the Virginia ratification debates, it was brought up several times that are we not going to join the Union and not have President Washington become the or General Washington become the first president of this nation? Because right. if we don't join, then we're not going to have him as president.
Right.
And so all of those things were in play. But
yeah.
Anyway,
how much do you think the Federalist Papers had to do with ratification in New York? Anything?
So the Federalist Papers were promulgated out to all of these other states that were currently meeting or getting ready to meet. And the Anti-Federalist Papers were promulgated in the same way. And in all honesty, there were certain papers that didn't run the Anti-Federalist Papers. There were more papers that didn't run the Anti-Federalist. And there were less papers that ran or wouldn't run the Federalist. So in other words, it seemed like the Federalist, the sentiments of ratifying the Constitution was much bigger, or it was a greater, group of, presses out there that wanted the Constitution ratified than there was, against it. So it was hard to get the Anti-Federalist message out, but, and people really cling on to the Federalist and Anti-Federalist debates, but the papers, their articles. Mm-hmm. Why are they turning their back? This is the heat of the debate. I mean, you're literally this person says this, and they like we saw with religion. Can they ask the question? Can they get involved in religion? Not at all. Mm-hmm. Back and forth. Boom. Very succinct. To the point. There's my question. Nope, not at all. There's the answer right there. And
right.
so. What the ratification debates offer, so we only got a minute left, so we'll have to put off the reading until we come back. But yeah. What the ratification debates offer is, to me, this clear back and forth. I'm asking this very specific question, and, this is the response to your question. And mm-hmm. going back and forth, where the Federalist Papers were really kind of done in vacuums. I mean, it was just like they first just started explaining stuff. Then the Anti-Federalists started saying, yeah, they say this, but, what about this, this, and this? Mm-hmm. And so then they started actually kind of responding to those. But it was not like a regular debate. They were just
right.
ideas that they had time to formulate and, maybe do research or what have you. But I think that the ratification debates really opens, the person's mind and eyes to actually both sides of the argument right there going back and forth. Go ahead.
Yeah, and I think back then they had them, which, and I'm guessing after the Civil War that information was lost because we don't have them now, except for you and for the effort that you're doing to make them widely and publicly available.
Right. It was, well, most people don't look at them as a treasure, as, like I do, and mm-hmm. as like yourself. And so as we start realizing that, man, these documents are really critical, and this is why, then, we can start sharing that with others, and then we can actually help grow, this wisdom and these insights that are only available in these documents. And so we're going into break. But folks, this is really, these documents are the only documents that are available that give you the clarity, literally the clarity on the Constitution. So folks, we're going to be right back after this one quick promo, and then we'll dive into the final comments, or I should say, the final citations out of the South Carolina debates.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. Friends, if you have any questions or comments, we have our 24-hour comment line at 425-270-5416.
Okay, so anyway, let's just get back into what these final comments are, and then we can kind of set the stage. Or maybe, actually, it might be better if there are any saved rounds or any other questions that you might have, Paul. We can kind of wrap those up before we dive into the Virginia ratification debates, because I'm not sure if during the break you hastily went to find your ratification debates for Virginia so that we could just kind of dive into those. But anyway, that's another question. So are you ready?
So we're ready. We have maybe 6 items left for South Carolina.
Uh-huh.
Right?
Yep.
And so I'm sure that by the time we jump into Virginia, I'll have it.
Okay. All right. So... Anyway, so this is Commerce by Mr. Pinckney. So some of these are kind of short, as you'll see. And so this is where, you know, they kind of define or discuss the delegated powers of Commerce. So go ahead. On May 14th, this is what he says.
Okay. I do not agree with him so far as to suppose that Commerce is generally cheating. I think there are some kinds of commerce not only fair and valuable, but such as ought to be encouraged by government. I agree with him in this principle, in this general principle, that all the great objects of government should be subservient to the increase of agriculture and the support of the landed interest, and that commerce should only be so far attended to as it may serve to improve and strengthen them. That the object of a republic is to render its citizens virtuous and happy, and that an unlimited foreign commerce can seldom fail to have a contrary tendency.
So, what he's really talking about here, so this isn't really, you know, heaven parting if you don't understand that America was facing a split in, I'll just say, industries or in paradigms of where how we were centered. Now, this really was probably epitomized between Jefferson and Hamilton. Now, Jefferson, just like Mr. Pinckney, they felt that the market and what would be best for America was to maintain an agrarian society. Now, even though, even in an agrarian society, we found that, you know, slavery was actually coming to an end. The reality was that bringing in an industrial society instead of an agrarian society would actually help fuel the ending of slavery. Because now, you know, it's easy because you have a factory and you just, you know, go to work and you can get a job. And this became a huge shift. Now, there are a lot of people that look at America becoming industrialized that, you know, we really turned our back on, you know, God's plan. Do you see that?
Well, how could we avoid becoming industrialized? You see what I'm saying?
Sure.
So in other words, what we may have become industrialized, and it took us, it took a lot of families off the land.
Uh-huh.
And but people still worked. Okay, we advanced.
Yep.
It's possible that, you know, this industrial revolution was fueled by knowledge and innovation that was inspired. So I wonder if we could look somewhere else to why we turned away from God. You understand what I'm saying? In other words, this.
So what
the world we live in has been, I think, that a lot of our technology and industrialization may have been inspired. On the other hand, it can also be used or abused by how should I say this, uninspired forces or even evil forces?
Yeah, so when I say turn from God, what I mean by that is when we look at the family farming, the family business, it mm-hmm. was business of the land, business of, you know, raising cattle or livestock, or, you know, both plant and livestock, or plant and harvesting plants. And so a person and their industry was kind of expanded, and land ownership was necessary, and right. it helped develop wealth. And, you know, that was true, because as people obtained more and more assets and resources and handed those down to their, you know, to their children, then these children had a great advantage by their inheritance in being able to continue the family business, whatever those things were, and to expand upon them and grow them. And so Jefferson saw this as more, and a lot of people looked at that as just a more righteous way to go. But the reality is, what would have happened if America did not look favorably upon bringing factories and factory production into America? Because I'll tell you what would have happened. Other nations would have started building steel ships when we had wooden ships.
Right.
And so it was in our, not only in our interest, but in our necessity of being able to maintain a level of security for our liberty. We had to go down that path.
I think that's right. As someone who has lived both in the city, using technology as a career, and then lived in the country and has spent some years in an agrarian lifestyle. Okay, I mean, we raised our own goats and rabbits and chickens, and at one point we raised sheep. I can tell you that living from the land is a godly enterprise. Not only that, families worked together, they had businesses, and by natural consequences of doing that, your children learn to work. You understand what I mean?
Yep.
And because of that,
yes.
it inculcates that, it builds that in as we become a society that has more leisure time. I think it's important, whatever our circumstances are, that we teach our children to work.
Right.
This has been something that's occupied my mind. I said, what do you do if you're not in an agrarian society? Probably the most valuable thing you can do outside of teaching the word of God is to teach them to work.
Okay, so what happens is when you look at the farm and the farm industry, it's almost like a closed system. In other mm-hmm. words, it produces everything that it needs, practically everything that it needs. When you look at George Washington and his farm and plantation, he had his own, you know, ironworks where he was making his own nails, building, and, you know, they made almost everything that they needed. In other words, they didn't buy stuff. They produced everything.
Right.
And so it was where they were starting to buy things from factories because it was just cheaper and more convenient and didn't have to waste the time that it took because they just got more efficient at the factory level to bring their costs down to where it just was a no-brainer. We're going to buy these cheaper nails. We're going to buy the because they're just as good, if not better. Right. And so they were a closed system. When you look at a factory and the industrial market, you how do you live? Okay, you go and earn money, but you have to earn enough money to buy, you know, your rent. You have to have a place to stay. You have to have food. You're not growing food anymore. You're working in a factory. So what ends up coming in an industrialized society is services, where now all of a sudden you start, you know, figuring and going down these paths of entertainment and these other things because you're bringing more and more people closer together. When you look at the industrial society, the industrial society had people living very close to each other where they didn't need these big pastures, these big agrarian farms. They had, you know, the stores. They would bring those into them. So that became, I think, the opening of where the, some of the services, because it's about supply and demand. People all of a sudden wanted services that would have been reprehensible, you know, from those people coming right off the farm. But it takes a little bit of time for the mores or the morals to start being debased when you bring people closer together and they're not focused on the family in the same aspect in the family business. If that all makes sense, it really opens the door towards, you know, living more unrighteously.
So that leaves a question. With the advent of what we call progress, how, there's a question that I think about, how do you build the moral nature of a society as you bring closer together? In other words, this drawing away from God and temptation comes as you bring people closer together. So how do you, well, I'll tell you some ideas that come to mind, okay? Now that I ask it, you don't allow your government to go outside of its bounds, okay?
Okay.
You don't allow things like the Great Society that took fathers out of homes in the 60s to leave the society to inherit fatherless boys who are undisciplined to just rebuild the process over and over. I think now that we're considering this, I think part of the problem is, when I look back, is that government intrusion and especially federal intrusion and especially money powers paying for the government to go outside of its enumerated delegated powers is part of the problem. You know, I really don't think that industrialization by itself has done this.
So I brought it up yesterday. And actually, what ends up happening is you, because what was the currency in 1776? What was the standard currency amongst, you know, the states and so forth? Well, they used a currency called a cash crop.
You're not talking about the continental, are you?
Yeah, so I'm just talking about this concept that even back in those days, they had a cash crop.
Okay.
Right? And the cash crop was tobacco. Prior to the Revolutionary War, you know, even though they did have currency, you know, in most of the agrarian, you know, areas, people would actually grow. They would bring and that was their currency. They would bring that in. They would get all this credit instead of actually having silver. They would get these silver credits because not a lot of people may have had that. And then they would basically charge against those credits and what have you, because they didn't have that, the abundance of coins, and it was far more That's why they said in some of these ratification debates that people were not, you know, once they gave up that silver coin, it was chance of never coming back.
Right.
So anyway, so they, in the farms, they weren't living around money and they didn't need money to live. They were, they were self-sufficient in so many different ways, but that's how they earned, you know, in their, they received money.
Right. Exchange with others.
Right. But in a industrial society, money becomes integral. Mammon. Goes back to mammon, because that was the path that allowed us to actually start living for and focused on it all becoming money, about money. Working for money, you know, working for more money, getting ahead, getting more money, even though you're more than comfortable with your situation and what have you, you chase more money because you want more. And so I think that that's one of the big reasons why there's these perceptions. But anyway, let's get back to, if we're going to finish it today, because we got about 12 minutes. The next one is a good lengthy one. It's about the unicameral bodies of government. Okay. So go ahead.
Sure. This is still Mr. Charles Pinckney.
Pinckney, yep.
In Pennsylvania and Georgia, the whole powers of government are lodged in a legislative body of a single branch, over which there is no control, nor are there executives or judicials from their connection and necessary dependence on the legislature, capable of strictly executing their respective offices. In all states except Maryland, Massachusetts, and New York, they are only so far improved as to have a legislature with two branches, which completely involve and swallow up all the powers of their government. And neither of these are the judicial or executive placed in that firm and or independent situation which can alone secure the safety of the people or the just administration of the laws. In Maryland, one branch of their legislature is a Senate chosen for 5 years by electors chosen by the people. The knowledge and firmness which this body have upon all occasions displayed, not only in the exercise of their legislative duties, but in withstanding and defeating such of the projects of the other house as appear to them founded in local and personal motives, have long since convinced me that the Senate of Maryland is the best model of a Senate that has yet offered to the Union, that it is capable of correcting many of the vices of the other parts of their Constitution, and in great measure atoning for those defects which, in common with the states I have mentioned, are but too evident in their execution. The want of stability and independence in the judicial and executive departments. In Massachusetts, we find the principle of legislation more improved by the revisionary power which is given to their governor and the independence of their judges. In New York, the same improvement in legislation has taken place as in Massachusetts, but here, from the executives being elected by the great body of the people, holding his office for 3 years, and being re-eligible from the appointment to offices being taken from the legislature and placed in a select council, I think their constitution is, upon the whole, the best in the Union. Its faults are the want of permanent salaries to their judges and giving to their executive the nomination to offices, which is, in fact, giving him the appointment.
Okay. So they kind of go through these different government configurations and kind of point out some advantages between one and the other and some of these different principles. But the interesting thing that he, you know, that begs, I guess, to be injected here is that when we look at how these governments were framed, so why is this important? Because did these governments actually have a bicameral legislative body? And that's the whole point, why it's why the note over it is unicameral. In other words, here are clearly some states that had unicameral legislative bodies. But but after the Constitution, they actually reconfigured into a bicameral legislative body. In other words, the Constitution transformed America and America's government into this concept of a dual sovereignty legislative body, to where the people had its representation and the sub-element of government, or what I would like to actually say, the parent of that general government, the counties, you know, had their own representation as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, okay. the way some of the states deployed it, some of the states, based on population and so forth, actually may have, you know, increased the Senate, you know, representation. In other words, I don't think they really understood the whole point, and I don't think they did a very good job. And they, you know, I just think that they were lacking some fundamental understandings of this representation of the sovereigns. In other words, there were a lot of people that by this point in time, they didn't really look at their counties as being that important, because the government itself wasn't that important, because there were, you know, the only reason they were creating a state so that the state would act, so they would have some advantages with being part of the union.
Okay.
Right? Because now that you're a state, now you actually have representation, you can actually start getting things. So forming a state was to the benefit of everybody else, because now you can participate in, you know, the union itself and obtain those benefits of being a member of the union. So I look at, you know, the reason why people marginalized their county was they didn't see the importance of creating the state to actually serve the counties. They looked at the reason why they created states was to become a part of the union. So they failed to understand that the bottom side, in other words, when you look at the top side interfacing with the federal government, they didn't really consider how the counties would be interfacing with them and withholding very specific powers from them, you know, over the counties and the people of the counties. Does that make sense?
Kind of.
Okay.
So the counties were, they didn't realize the value of the counties.
What was the county government providing? And I mean, did they have constructions and building roads and building infrastructure, building dams, you know, maintaining parks? I mean, what was they doing? For the most part, they were enforcing the law and conducting elections.
Okay.
That's it. So the county board, the board of supervisors was just making sure, you know, that they were creating, you know, that's how they started creating blue laws. That's how they started going down the path of, you know, defining the crimes, prostitution's illegal, or prostitution's going to be legal here. Mm. So, not that that happened very often, but the point is that the counties didn't really have a representative body where you were electing your representatives. However, when governments are formed in America, the governments have to be separated. So you have this Republican form of government, but you also have to have a separation of powers. In other words, the judiciary has to be separate from an executive and has to be separate from the legislative.
Right.
That's why all the states were configured the way they were, and counties needed to have that same configuration. But they didn't see the need because, you know, they didn't want more government. They didn't want government in their everyday lives. They wanted to actually have a very limited state government and, you know, let them go and live the way they want to live.
Mm-hmm.
And as government ended up convincing them that, well, if we can do this, we can do this, it was all based on, you know, taxation, right? Well, we can do this, but we'll have to tax you. We can do this, and so some of the things may have been for good reasons and good purposes for improving the productivity, like highways and infrastructure. But other things, social engineering, became very destructive. And so the counties in America in the mid-1900s, the counties are actually beginning to actually push back and hold up, you know, the states from being able to do more things. And so this is one of the reasons why I truly believe that they recognized that they had to get rid of county governments so the states could be, you know, the thugs for the federal government.
Sure.
They took away our local protection.
Right.
Right. Okay, so the next one is Sovereign. It talks about sovereigns. It's very short.
Kind of short.
Yep. And so we have 3 minutes. So
yeah.
Okay.
Okay. In every government, there necessarily exists a power from which there is no appeal, and which, for that reason, may be formed absolute and uncontrollable. The person or assembly in whom this power resides is called the sovereign or supreme power of the state. There's a sentence here that's not highlighted.
Uh-huh.
It says, with us, the sovereignty of the union is in the people.
Right.
Okay?
Right.
So that's a question that...
So go ahead and highlight that. Go ahead and highlight it.
Yeah, okay. And that's the question, you know, that I often get about who's sovereign. We've had this discussion multiple times. Do the people cede their sovereignty or delegate their sovereignty to their representatives?
Well, so you first have to understand your relationship and interface with government in the system. Your intimate relationship in government that you have full control over, full control, in almost a democratic form. Other than you have, you know, a three, you should have the separations of powers is your county. Because bottom line, you know, you have the ability to actually go and get in their face. You live there. It's available to you. It's usually within an hour drive or less for some people, based on the size of the county. But it's a reasonable, and this is where most all the power of government resides, is because this is where everybody can be directly involved in, you know, overseeing that because what happens when we institute government, when we've instituted it, we've legitimized it by giving and surrendering to it very specific powers.
Mm-hmm.
If it's a democracy and we don't institute government, that we, the people, are the sovereigns in all things, then what that means is that we are the government itself. So when it says, and this is one of the reasons why I didn't have that highlighted, but with us, the sovereignty of the union is in the people. Yeah, that's true, in the people at the lowest level. Then we institute a government, and this county government is our first layer of support and protection from threats, both external and internal. So they have to be your warriors in making sure that the state is staying within its bounds. Because who instituted your state government?
Well, it would be, it's not that obvious in many cases, but it would be the counties.
The counties, absolutely, because the counties would send delegates, even though they didn't have this, and this is the problem. It's not necessarily a problem. We've ran out of time. It's not necessarily a problem, but it helps. I think it causes people to lose sight of the importance of the separation layers of government. We'll bring this back up in our next episode tomorrow, folks, so that we can kind of help people understand this sovereignty, dual sovereignty, and what it all means. So I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
The reason progressives are effective in instituting their policies is because they are united ideologically, financially, and socially. In addition, almost every billionaire in the world is funding a vast array of different groups, and these groups' efforts are to undermine our republic and our constitution. If you don't believe me, just Google donors to the Open Society Foundations. The only way we're going to successfully combat these efforts and take back our liberties, like our education system, healthcare, state lands, housing, labor, and many other roles, responsibilities and powers that belong to the states, is by you and I and local businesses getting involved in supporting political programs and efforts based on constitutional principles. The best way to do this is supporting result-oriented organizations designed to take back our lost liberties. The ultimate result-oriented effort is Republic Review. So please consider contributing to the show and the organizations and activities that we are supporting by going to reclaimingtherepublic.org and go to the contribution page, and you can become a listed supporter of Liberty.